listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with Tony Solo, a reporter from south of the border, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Okay, let's start with the Pope.
Yeah, there's Pope Francis is making a visit, or has been making a visit to Chile, and is currently in Peru. The visit in Chile lasted 3 or 4 days. He visited indigenous peoples. He went to a women's prison. He did a mass. Public mass, and the main themes during his visit to Chile were indigenous people's rights, because he was expected to kind of give some kind of, not necessarily outspoken backing, but some support to the rights of the Mapuche people in Chile. The Mapuche people are an indigenous group who have had their land taken over the last few centuries. First by the Spanish, then by the independence elites after Chile gained its independence. And through this century, they've also been facing, or over the last 80-100 years, they've been facing depredation from foreign corporate interests that are interested in their land. In the Mapuche people are probably, it's difficult to get reliable figures. It depends on how people define what the ethnicity of that group is. But, and you could say between 1 million and 1.5 million people in Chile are probably of Mapuche descent. And there's another significant population in Argentina as well, some people say they're around 250,000, some people say they're as many as 700,000 in Argentina. But anyway, there are substantial indigenous group, a minority in both Chile and in Argentina, and the Pope was expected to make some kind of pronouncement in their favor. But he played that very low-key, presumably on the basis of some understanding with Michelle Bachelet, the Chilean president. The other theme that he was supposed to talk about from the point of view of public opinion was the issue of clerical sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests in Chile, and the accusation that a very senior bishop in Chile had been covering up for those abuses. And he played that very low-key. He upset some people because he defended the bishop who was accused of covering those abuses up. But in general, it's difficult to see if there's any significant balance from Pope Francis' visit, either in Chile or currently his visit in Peru, because all he seems to be saying is, it would be great if everybody would be nicer to each other. And, you know, what kind of message is that?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It happens to be true, wouldn't it? But it doesn't exactly induce the desired condition just by expressing it. Hey, yeah, wouldn't it be? Well, you know, I mean, that's kind of what. that's what Trump said about, you know, being friends with Russia. Wouldn't it be nice? That's about as much policy as he articulated, and they're still all going that crazy
I'm not being fair to Pope Francis, but I'm looked up from this distance. Peru has a huge Roman Catholic population. Something over 70% of the Peruvian population are quite strong Roman Catholics.
Right.
There's a less devoted population, Roman Catholic population in Chile, but it's a very important visit from that point of view. A very important visit in terms of promoting the idea of Latin America as and now there's this Latin American Pope, and he's paying serious attention to the very difficult problems facing Latin America. So yeah, and from a pastoral point of view, it was a very big deal for the Roman Catholic population in those countries, but somewhat controversial.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's something interesting about this. Why are you talking about Peru generally and this? You know, the Pope, the first Latin American Pope, there's now when he travels, there are certain, you know, framing of issues that go on in Latin America. For example, you know, in the United States, we had the same thing with the, you know, sexual abuse by the priests of, you know, young kids, mostly young boys, altar boys and such, and a cover-up. And it was very divisive issue inside the Catholic Church and over in the Vatican. You know, now we see, because this Pope is from the region, when he goes there, you know, this is something that's, you know, thrown in his face, because he was one of the people, you know, he's part of the establishment there while this was an issue. Other issues in Latin America also, watching the U.S. Security Council yesterday, they had discussion about proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, not just nuclear weapons, but chemicals and ICBMs and all this stuff. And almost like the old days of Yugoslavia versus Albania, with you know, ideological discussion via proxy of the Soviet and China's camp, was Bolivia, on the one hand, speaking to the issue, Peru now on the Security Council for this term, you know, sort of articulating the U.S. point of view on the Security Council, you know, couched in regional terminology and imagery. You know, Bolivia is very strong anti-war. You know, it's a zone of peace, you know, the whole situation there. That gets articulated on a global stage on a regular basis now. Almost any international question, Bolivia, you know, speaking out an independent position on the one hand, but also one that's born of the evolutionary process that's been ongoing in Latin America and South America in particular, with sovereignty, independent course, independent of the United States in particular. And so that gets articulated frequently in support of China, in support of Iran, in support of, depending on who it is at the UN, by Bolivia. And now this year, we're seeing the counter argument being made by Peru, which is now also on the world stage as a consequence of its membership on the Security Council. So we got the Pope kind of doing that, inside the, as far as with the trappings of the Catholic Church and the role that that played, kind of evokes the role that the Polish Pope, so-called, played in the 80s. And now also this, sort of this drama that takes place at the UN. This is the second or third time I've seen it since the beginning of the year when Peru was ascended.
Yeah, I don't want to get bogged down in the Pope's visit, because in overall terms, it was really kind of not of central importance in terms of the current issues facing Latin America, which sounds a strange thing to say. And the only exception to that, and one in the Pope's favor, and also related to the expectations of his advocacy and support of indigenous peoples in the region, is climate change. The Pope has been very, very clear that the climate change is a major problem and should be dealt with, taken very seriously, and in strong contrast to the position taken by most of the world's rich countries. And so in that regard, and that aspect of his visit is probably quite important. But on the whole, I don't think his visit is going to it doesn't have any strong symbolic meaning or change or significance. It's difficult to think of anything very positive to say about that visit, except that he is definitely advocating on this visit in a very low-key way on behalf of the indigenous people and on behalf of ensuring that people take climate change seriously, which is very important. But anyway, and the what you were just saying about Peru somehow curiously advocating or putting forward the United States point of view in terms of non-proliferation and non-aggression and all that, all those very, very, very fundamental international issues of just kind of getting along together, right. And that is also reflected in a meeting that's happening over the next. I think it started today, and I think it finishes on Sunday. It's a meeting of the CELAC countries and China. And that's really, really important. There was I put up on the site last night a very interesting interview, not because of it was a very extensive or deep interview with Alicia Bárcena, who's the director of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, a UN body that develops policy and offers policy guidance and tries to coordinate policy initiatives in the region to promote the economic development of the region. Now, she's essentially a strong social democrat, taking strong, very, very conventional economic policy positions in terms of her policy recommendations. But it's really interesting to see how she is absolutely clear that unless Latin America operates as a bloc and in its dealings with the world, and in particular with major economic powers, leading global economic powers like China, they're not going to be able to get the best deal for the peoples of the region. So she's strongly advocating that CELAC works for more integration, in particular on policy, and in particular on economic policy, and taking steps, for example, to improve skills exchange, knowledge exchange, exchange of technology, which she says is a very strong component of China's overall economic development package and the package that it offers its potential partners, in strong contrast, of course, to the United States and the European Union, who tend to be very mean about technological exchange.
Yeah.
So Alicia Bárcena was also very clear that Latin America will not be doing the best for its people if its economic policy isn't geared to diversifying away from simple raw materials exports with no value added. And that people have been saying that for decades now.
Right.
But the difference now is that Latin America has a potential partner in China.
That's right.
And in other Asian countries that is interested in that kind of technological development, scientific development, an exchange of knowledge, helping its partners diversify so that they become more attractive partners to China itself.
Right, and part of the diversification, first of all, is the diversification of options for Latin America from the Monroe Doctrine model, which is essentially, okay, we have a gun pointed at your head, we're taking your stuff, sit down and shut up, you keep a gun trained on them. That's basically the model that's been followed. Now that's changing. China is engaging there, and apparently this CELAC was meeting also in Chile, right?
In Santiago de Chile.
Yeah, so, and apparently Argentina and Chile are the two, you know, sort of the keys to this process, whether they're going to be, even though you have right-wing governments more or less now in each of the two places, can they stake out an independent course for their own countries? And like we've said before, kind of this model of, independence, of, exerting their sovereignty, of charting their own course, of economic consolidation, that has brought back rewards that are so compelling that even the right-wing governments have been compelled to follow that model many ways. And so is that what's going to – are the potential benefits of doing business with China in a win-win situation so compelling that even the right-wing governments installed by the U.S. will see it as, preferable to dealing with the U.S.?
Yeah, and this brings us back to what you were saying earlier. Like Peru advocating positions of the United States on certain global issues, but its core interests, its core economic interests, depend on how well it develops its relationship with China and the other Asian countries. The only relationship it's, as you just pointed out, the only relationship it's going to develop with the United States is the traditional looting relationship that the United States has always imposed on Latin American countries.
Right.
So there's this deep contradiction. Now, Alicia Bárcena is a very smart woman, but I think she has these ideological limitations. So, for example, she'll say Latin American countries have to do more to integrate with China and deal with China if they're going to make real changes to benefit their populations. And when she says that, and she'll say the countries that have done most to promote that are the Pacific Alliance countries. But that's not true. The country that has done most to promote its relation, and the two countries that have done most to promote their relations with China, are Venezuela and Cuba.
Right.
Why is Alicia Bárcena saying, that the Pacific Alliance countries are the ones that have done most to develop their relationship with China? She's saying that because her model is a capitalist model, tending towards free trade, traditional economic theory, the idea that free markets tend to equilibrium. This is what is so strange about many of the individuals who often have a very positive contribution to make. But they have these insane beliefs that, the free markets don't tend to equilibrium.
Right.
How can anybody still believe that?
Right. You have to look at history. Look at history. How do we have such a lack of equilibrium?
Sorry, the only reason I mention that is because this demonstrates how actually revolutionary what Venezuela is trying to do. It really is.
Yep.
Because it's like cognitive dissonance. Is that the phrase, cognitive dissonance?
Yes.
Alicia Bárcena, this very talented, very smart woman, with lots of positive contributions to make in terms of Latin America's development. She just can't recognize or isn't prepared to recognize publicly the revolutionary change that Venezuela's model has brought to Latin America. And, yeah, and in a very positive way.
Right.
And what she's saying about Latin American unity is exactly what Cuba and Venezuela, Bolivia, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa in Ecuador before he had to stand down as president in Ecuador. And all these progressive leaders are pushing for precisely what Alicia Bárcena's arguing for: regional integration, right, closer regional integration, a unified policy in order to deal with leading global economic powers like China and the European Union, let alone the United States. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty, and her public statements reflect the conventional, insane, false beliefs.
Right. You know, this is an argument that's been ongoing. I mean, what she's basically doing is exhibiting what is often done by some people that are characterized perhaps as ultra-leftists. I wouldn't use the term myself. But, basically ideological dogmatism, that you're so blinded by a hook of some ideological point that you can't see the forest for the trees, or even the trees. It's the same way with those that criticize Venezuela from the left, by the way, which is not what I'm saying she's doing. And that is, they fail to see the point that you're raising, which is true. On the fundamental question of imperialism in Latin America, which has been the biggest stumbling block to its development, the model that Venezuela has helped to flesh out, along with Cuba, and then with the ALBA countries, and then in the larger constructs, including CELAC and others, is independence from U.S. imperialism, which has been the main problem for a century and change there. And yeah, that solving that problem opens up the possibilities of everything else. Not solving that problem means that you continue in that condition and nothing is possible.
Yeah, and one of the issues about these right-wing countries, and the president of Peru is this right-wing guy, Kuczynski. You have Mauricio Macri in Argentina. You're going to have Sebastian Piñera soon in Chile. You're going to have another right-wing president almost certainly in Colombia. Who knows what? While we're talking about this, and what you're talking about is when Hugo Chavez was alive, he, Daniel Ortega, when Fidel was still alive, and now Raul has taken over from Fidel, and somebody new will take over from Raul with very little change in the overall regional policy from Cuba. But what they're saying is, it doesn't matter what our ideological differences are. We've got to work together through CELAC to build a unified policy position for Latin America that's going to benefit all our peoples.
Right.
And so what the right wing are doing is they're sabotaging that. CELAC has been virtually it's been kind of neutralized in terms of activity, except for these kinds of trade and economic policy summits that are crucially important even to the right wing. But the undercurrent at the moment, as a result of the coming to power of these right-wing leaders in the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff, Mauricio Macri taking power in Argentina, Kuczynski in Peru, the right-wing continuing power in Colombia, now someone I regard as an extreme right-winger coming to power in Chile. What that means is that they tend, because they are so split in their loyalties. On the one hand, they feel a strong attraction to, and they have strong loyalties to their U.S. kind of bosses, if you like.
Right.
in the region, but at the same time they recognize that their own material interests demand that they look towards Asia, especially China.
Right.
So what's happening is that in terms of the regional integration, the political initiatives in the region, those have been kind of put on ice for the moment. But the trade initiatives, the economic policy initiatives, they tend to move forward. And you can see that, for example, in the way the Pacific Alliance countries are trying to revive the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump abandoned shortly after taking office. I think China is trying to work with the countries that had hoped to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China is trying to kind of coax them into working, into developing a similar kind of agreement with that includes China, which the Trans-Pacific right. Partnership didn't.
Specifically so, didn't, right.
Yeah, so that's, that whole kind of bundle of kind of contradictions is one that's actually very debilitating for the region. And I think that's really what Alicia Bárcena was trying to talk about in that interview that she gave to Xinhua, the Chinese news agency.
Right. Although she was riddled with the same contradictions that she's essentially, you know, describing or that exist in any event as context for our conversation.
Yeah. Yep. So looking at that, and what might change that? Well, this year there's the possibility of some change. We don't know how likely those possibilities are going to be. I think it might help to give people a quick run through the schedule of elections this year. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes. Let's do that.
Okay. So on February the 4th, Costa Rica has its presidential election. There's unlikely to be a major change in Costa Rica, although the political scene there is much more confused than it used to be, because the traditional parties, that there used to be a basically two-party system there, and that's broken down. So, and there might be a surprise in Costa Rica, but it's very unlikely that they're likely to change their regional policy. Whoever wins the presidency in February, and in fact it's likely to go to a second round. I think the second round is sometime towards the end of March, because it's very unlikely that any candidate is going to get an outright majority on the first round. Then, as you pointed out when we had our last conversation, the Colombian parliamentary elections are on March the 11th,
right.
And they could be very important. There could be some change, in a similar way to there was some change in the Chilean parliament in the legislative elections in Chile last year. There may be more representation of social democrat leaning parties in Colombia. But the difficulty in Colombia is that Colombia is a country with something like, I think it's got 32 departments composed in total of over 1,100 municipalities. Now, of those 1,100 municipalities, over 270 are outright controlled by paramilitaries.
Ouch.
And those 275 municipalities are spread through something like 26, 27 of the country's 32 departments.
Ouch.
So that makes... You know, that makes complete nonsense of kind of democratic process in Colombia, which in any case, the parliamentary elections there, the whole political system, apart from the paramilitary influence, is notoriously corrupt. So then Colombia has its presidential elections on May the 27th, and it's likely to be... It's unlikely that the extreme right wing, somebody sympathetic to Álvaro Uribe, will win. There'll probably be another kind of center-right president similar to Juan Manuel Santos. Very unlikely that a left-wing candidate will make any headway at all. But I mean, that's that Colombian context, we need to talk about that in another program, because there's so much to talk about.
All the other stuff going on there too. But yeah, go ahead, next. Yeah. Yep.
Then in Paraguay, April the 22nd, that's what I saw. And up until recently, there was some doubt about when the presidential elections would be in Paraguay, but it's likely that a left-wing candidate similar to Fernando Lugo, because the crucial thing in all these elections, if the left-wing is going to do well, they have to combine. They can't let their differences split their vote. And in Paraguay, they seem to have learned that lesson. The left progressive parties are going into that election on pretty much a broad united ticket, and they're likely to win. We'll see.
Right.
The same in Mexico. In Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the kind of historic loser in Mexico, the historic victim of one fraudulent election after another, he looks as though he's leading the polls now, and he might very well win in Mexico, which would be a huge turnaround, a huge kind of upset, especially from the point of view of somebody like President Trump. So I'm quite positive results possible in Paraguay and Mexico. And in Brazil, everything turns on a decision that's going to be taken over the next few days in one of the superior courts in Brazil. It's one of the appeal levels that President Lula still has open to him. If the decision goes against him, that also is very complicated. There are all kinds of footnotes to add to that. But and if the decision does go against him, it could complicate his candidacy for the presidential elections that are scheduled for October.
Right.
But in Venezuela, the presidential elections are likely to be sometime in December. Right. So in Brazil, everything turns, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. And everything in Brazil does turn on whether Lula da Silva will be able to run in the presidential elections.
Right.
Because if he can't, it's difficult to see how Brazil's going to overcome its current crisis and the current offensive, the right-wing offensive against people's basic rights in Brazil. Well, and in Venezuela, the crucial thing is the government going to be able to bring prices under control? The consensus among people I know in Venezuela seems to be that the only thing that is going to allow the opposition and its United States backers to get what they want in Venezuela is if people finally give up because they can no longer tolerate the price inflation and speculation that the government hasn't been able to bring under control. But if the government does bring substantive measures into play to control prices in Venezuela, then I think there's no doubt at all that Nicolas Maduro will be reelected in December.
Yep. Yeah, and Lula is well ahead in the last poll. There was a poll done in late December in Brazil. I'd like to thank you for your time again and to speak with you again next week.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a million, Don. If we can, we should try and talk more about Colombia as well.
Yeah, we'll do that. Thanks a lot. Take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Well, the four-page memo detailing extensive FISA court abuse changed the course of what is known as Russiagate. Also, does the Trump administration's Syria policy make any sense? And who's the real bully, Trump or the media? Crosstalking real news, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Alex Cristoforo. He's a director and writer for TheDuran.com. And we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, as usual, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Alex, let me go to you first. This four-page memo. Now, if you watch Fox, it means something, and it means something big. You watch CNN, you might not even hear about it. Is this a partisan thing, or is there something there?
Well, to be honest, we don't really know yet, do we? I mean, you have Fox, which is building it up as explosive, scandalous.
Wow.
It's going to bring down the Obama administration. It's going to connect Obama to the DOJ, to the FBI, to the Clinton campaign, that they were spying on Trump, they were surveilling Trump. And then you have CNN and MSNBC who are saying, there's nothing there. I mean, the only thing you can really do is release the memo. And Glenn Greenwald is calling to release the memo. A lot of news outlets and a lot of people from Julian Assange, everybody's saying we got to release the memo because we don't really know. Laura Ingraham said on her show that there's one Democrat who has read this memo, which is located in some secret room for classified information, one Democrat, while all the Republicans have actually gone through the memo and they're shocked. And that's a quote. They're shocked at what they read.
Mark, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of it because of the partisan nature of both it and the Russiagate scandal that it concerns. One thing we have to say that we can all yell hashtag release the memo. It's so popular right now. But it's the Republican-controlled Congress that can release the memo, or Trump's White House that can order the memo declassified and release it to everyone. If they want it released, well, then release it already. Stop trying to make a public theater out of it. Let's see if there really is anything.
I mean, from what I understand, they're going to go through a process, and it will take like 19 days for it to be released. Okay, well, that's 19 days for this partisan lunchroom fight to continue. Okay, I mean, it will see. But, you know, Dima, one of the interesting things is that all while this new FISA bill, the 702 bill, that allows the NSA to continue this process of surveillance. I mean, the irony of ironies here, because it was probably because of Bill 702 that allowed something like this to happen. They renewed it. Trump signed it. Where was the debate? None.
Well, there's no doubt that NSA will continue spying and this whole Russiagate story will continue.
Yeah, warrantless wiretapping of American citizens.
Well, what I am interested in is when will people understand that this is just absurd? I mean, I keep my diary. They accused Russia of meddling in elections in Germany, France, Serbia, Italy, Malaysia. I mean, and these were serious American EU politicians saying it. It was not just some yellow paper, you know, saying that, oh, Russia could possibly try to meddle into elections in Serbia. Well, there are also smaller countries like Macedonia. They're afraid that Russia might hate Macedonia.
You can convince our viewers right now that the United States and its security agencies are not trying to affect Russia's upcoming presidential election.
Oh, absolutely. No. It's out of the question. You know, there are such beautiful people there participating, you know. The story with Navalny, you know, is making rounds.
To tell us who he is.
Navalny is a racist participant in the so-called Russia marches.
He's considered by many in the West
as a neoliberal,
but he's a quote-unquote a leader of the anti-Putin
opposition and anti-corruption crusader, as he is presented in the West.
Who has twice been convicted for fraud, including of a French cosmetics
company. Twice been connected for fraud in shady business deals, and he has a problem with a French perfume company, not with the Russian, only with Russian companies. However, it's an interesting case when the United States decided to throw their lot with a nationalist, with a racist. You know, this is a new technology for Russia. They did it in Ukraine. They did it in the Middle East. But in Russia, they're probably doing it for the first time, which will make this election cycle maybe interesting.
But
can we go back to the Trump issue, which is interesting,
sure,
because for the last week, what do we hear about Trump? That he's unstable mentally, that he's sick. Is he going to last, you know, all 4 years or 8 years? Get on a scale and show us your weight. So you had the whole media.
Even his height.
This guy is unfit to be president physically, mentally, but they give him unlimited powers to spy and surveil. They gave him an unprecedented military budget, voted both by Democrats and Republicans. So you can see, going back to what you said, the absurdity of it all.
Well, let's talk about another blank check here. Let's talk about Syria. Mark, you follow it probably better than anyone I know. The more I read about what the U.S. is trying to do in Syria, the more I do not understand, other than intentional destabilization of the country forever.
Well, that's what they've been doing for the last 6 years, illegally arming, training, and salarying militants allied and embedded with al-Qaeda to overthrow the Syrian government. The Trump administration finally, after months in, ended that Obama policy, but they doubled down on supporting the Kurds, which are affiliated with the YPG, which the U.S. has listed as a terrorist group largely because of its insurgent actions in Turkey against the Turkish regime of Erdogan.
But what we're having now, Dima, is that we have the U.S. throwing the Turks and the Kurds under the bus? The same bus?
Well,
I mean, the contradictions, the more you look at it, the more the contradictions are jarring, okay?
Well, the problem is that trying to remove a minor adversary, who was actually not an adversary, Syria, before 2011, the United States and the EU have lost a huge ally, Turkey, you know, a country at least four times more important than Syria.
And so, Iraq, the U.S. installed
absolutely.
A government
so they
Iraq.
Have already lost, you know. Their policy was self-destructive. It not only destroyed Syria, it also destroyed their own Middle East influence.
But it will continue. Alex, one of the things is, if we looked at what Secretary Tillerson had to say about Syria, which I thought it was like a visit to the Twilight Zone. Yeah. We could make a whole program on it. But there will be an embargo, a blockade, a sanction against rebuilding Syria. The U.S. will actively push that. Thus, the refugees that left, that went to Europe, will not be able to come back because there'll be nothing to come back to. So this perpetuates this problem.
The EU has and, the same policy.
Exactly, and we'll actually see, because there won't be any reconstruction, more refugees flooding into Europe.
Absolutely.
I mean, again, so who are the winners in all of this? I don't see anyone, just because the United States is trying to spite Assad, Iran and Russia.
Alternative parties in Europe, the ones that the United States and the EU hate so much, I mean, they will be asking these obvious questions, and then the mainstream media in the EU will say, Russians are spreading all of these news and questions.
And it is so obvious. I mean, could you not have seen that Turkey would never, ever in a million years allow any sort of Kurdish state, quasi-state, border security forces, whatever they call it, under their country, a presence underneath Turkey, a 30 million Kurds in Turkey. There was no way Turkey would ever allow it in a million years. They didn't see this?
Trump campaigned on ending the process of nation building, ending the process, the euphemism of democracy promotion, and ending regime changes, which he said as counterproductive and destructive to U.S. policy across the Middle East. He also said, what are we doing in Syria? If Hillary Clinton has her way, we will be starting World War III with Russia in Syria over al-Qaeda. And this is, the Trump administration has completely capitulated to the neocons, you know, and their run running Trump's foreign policy. Tillerson now said a permanent, indefinite U.S. military occupation of Syria. Their goals are now open regime change once again, back to the Obama era, confronting Iran, because Iran is not allowed to have influence in Syria, no matter what Damascus said. I think Tillerson should give us a list of the countries in the world that are allowed to decide who their allies are and which ones aren't. Because it's always complained in Eastern Europe that countries are allowed to ally with and join NATO if they want. But Syria is not allowed to ally with Iran.
Always an exception. Go ahead, David.
So I think we need to explain to our viewers who might not watch the news in the last 2 days what happened in Syria. What happened was a Turkish invasion. It is a fact. The Russian forces have removed themselves from the area that Turkey is actually occupying. But it was a response to what? To the United States' claim that they're going to create a huge so-called border security
without
force.
Without even consulting the Turks. Their NATO ally.
Sputnik International took an interview from the former UK ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, who said the following, which I think is pretty exact. The United States has been trying to prevent Syria from stabilizing itself as a unitary sovereign state. Now they see a way of partially implementing it by encouraging the formation of a Kurdish stateland. Right. So the response to it was the Turkish invasion.
Well, essentially, I think we have to explain to our viewers, this is an attempt at partitioning Syria permanently.
Multiple.
Okay,
a Turkish attempt and an American attempt.
Right.
At the same time.
And at the behest, I would say, of the Saudis and the Israelis here. Because our viewers have to understand, it's very clear the United States has no geopolitical national interest in Syria. And the American forces are there illegally under international law. There was no United Nations Security Council authorization. And Turkey is violating the sovereignty also.
Our viewers should understand that the EU is making things worse, because their policy that we will provide economic aid only to the areas which are not under control of the Syrian government, that policy perpetuates the presence of refugees in the countries like Germany, France. So next time when Merkel will be telling to you, oh, there was simply no way I couldn't accept these refugees, I hope the German voters will tell her about the EU policy of not financing the parts of the country that are under control of the Syrian government.
So, Turkey is invading and attacking the Kurdish canton of Afrin, which has actually been Russian protected. It wasn't supported by the U.S.
We'll continue.
We
have to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Real News. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, Mark, you wanted to finish up on Syria. Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically what we've got with this Turkish attack on Afrin is we've got a Mexican standoff, a three-way Mexican standoff between Russia and the Syrian government on one side, between Turkey and its proxies, which are al-Qaeda and the 31 flavors of jihad in support of the whole war, including the formerly U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army on the other, and the U.S. and its Kurdish proxies on the other. And they're in a three-way face-off. Russia would like Turkey and the United States to fight to drive a wedge between Turkey and NATO. The United States would like the Turks to fight Russia over Afrin Canton because that would help destroy this very fragile, essentially falling apart agreement for the stabilization of Syria with the Ostinaw Agreement, and it further destabilized Syria. This is where we're at. It's an extremely tense situation. The writing was on the wall a long time. We've long argued it was going to happen. And the hours and days ahead, what Erdogan actually does, how much damage he does in Syria, and whether he will then turn on the American-backed Kurds is up in the air.
You know, the interesting thing is that one has to wonder where Turkish soldiers go. Do they stay, or do they, you know, do they have, you know, it's like the Russians went in, had a mission, said mission accomplished, very limited aims, did what they wanted to do, and basically withdrew. Will the Turks stay? Okay. Again, we're looking at another
partition. They will stay.
Well, the Turks will most likely stay.
It's like Cyprus.
My impression is that Russia kind of acquires to the fact that there will be Turkish influence in the north of Syria. Russia kind of agrees that there is a Turkish minority there, so they have their interest. We cannot save Syria alone, right? Let's be realistic about it. And I'm not sure Russia really wants to drive a wedge between Turkey and NATO. I think we would like to be in peace with everyone.
Maybe they want to, but they don't really have to worry about it because it's already happening anyway.
I think another question to ask is who sanctioned the U.S. to be in Syria for so long? I mean, going back to what Mark said, this goes against everything that Trump ran for.
And this is actually an interesting precedent for regime change. This is the first time that the United States has sent in troops illegally to a country and then decided it would be regime change. It's a nuance in regime change playbook.
It's a nuance, and what happens to the U.S. forces there once Turkey does go in and set up a permanent camp in the north? Where does the U.S. go? Where do the troops go? What are they doing there? What's their purpose? What's their goal? What result are they looking to get out of this?
I'll tell you what it is.
Why is the media
Iran.
Not
exactly. It's always about
Why
Iran.
Is the
it's
media not reporting
it's always
this?
About Iran at
I
the end of the day.
It's about spite. It's simple spite. Okay. They lost. They know that a military presence there isn't going to inhibit Iran in any way, shape, or form. And they're simply acting out of spite and hatred at this point. They want to play. They can't do anything against Damascus except play the spoiler. So that's what they're going to do.
Okay. Well, last word on Syria.
Just, you know, from a Russian point of view, we have a conflict with the United States, with the EU. So Turkey may be our last, transit country probably for the oil and gas to be sold to Europe. So I think Russia will try to maintain good relations with Turkey despite all the disagreements.
It was Turkey that shot down a Russian plane. And every Russian soldier that has died in Syria has died because the Turks armed jihadists terrorizing Syria.
Not only Turks, but many other countries.
But they couldn't do it without Turkey's border.
Mm-hmm. Okay, everyone's going to pay a high price for this. I just wanted to touch real quickly, gentlemen. There was a new national defense strategy. I think it's the first one since 2011. And its focus is the greatest security threats for the United States is China and Russia. I mean, an interesting change because before it was transnational threats like terrorism, even the environment, and now we're going back to a very kind of simplistic Manichaean world where it's the Russians, the Chinese. It's like the 19th century again.
You're absolutely right. I think it's much worse than the Cold War. And the funny thing is that Trump accused Russia of not being active enough on isolating North Korea economically, while the United States Congress put Russia in the same group with North Korea and Iran. So you have to decide.
We have to point out here is that Russia was sanctioned, and then they asked the U.S. asked the Russians to sanction North Korea. I mean, that's really rich, gentlemen.
And the recent talks, the recent discussion in the U.S. Congress on Islamist threat, Russia and North Korea, and Russian propaganda, that sounded to me like ragtag and bobtail that we are going to discuss. Islamist threat, North Korea, and Russia.
Okay, you're going in the direction I want to go to. Let's talk about what's going on in social media. I suppose all of us got that little note from Twitter. I did. Alex, did you get one? You didn't get one.
I didn't get one.
Whoa,
I feel neglected again.
Wow. Did you get one?
They probably gave up on me. I didn't get it.
Well, I found
he's not Russian. He's not an American.
No, but what I would suggest to our viewers, anyone that got that, I think almost 700,000 people.
700,000 people got it.
What I suggest to our viewers is all of them just go to the internet, look up the U.S. Constitution and copy the First Amendment, paste it, and send it right back to Twitter. Thank you very much. I know what my First Amendment, my freedom of speech rights are. I don't need a company like Twitter to tell me what free speech is, what I should read, and what I shouldn't read.
Well, Twitter and Facebook are now almost working in unison, and I think we know the forces behind Twitter and Facebook that are pushing them to do this. And so Twitter is basically saying, look, we know from all the evidence that there are Russian trolls and Russian influence on Twitter.
Potentially Russian linked.
Yeah, so their message was a warning to people. It was very creepy, very big brotherish.
It was creepy.
You know, it's like, we know that you're following certain Russian trolls. We're watching you, but be careful.
You may have liked something that Russian or potentially Russian linked person
Facebook, on the other hand, is going to do this. They're going to rank and they're going to rate reputable news sources, and they're going to make sure their readers get to these reputable news sources, while the other unreputable news sources, the ones they don't want you to read, just kind of disappear.
Will they tell us how this process is going to be done? I mean, is there any transparency here, or is it just trust me?
Algorithms. Yeah. Algorithms and anonymous.
Algorithms. Yeah,
exactly. Facebook conducted an internal investigation into the Russian influence on the UK referendum and found out that Russia spent, 0.97 cents on the adverts targeting the UK referendum. So Russia meddled for just €1, and that was terrible meddling. Barack Obama went to London, spoke in favor of the stay vote, and it was not meddling. He was just there.
Well, I mean,
all
Western media, when I look at Europe, when I look in the United States, Canada, all of them supported Hillary Clinton. But that wasn't meddling? That wasn't meddling? Meddling?
And all of them supported the stable.
Facebook's COO came out and said she supported Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Sandberg said it multiple times.
Twitter, okay, fair enough. They've sent out a letter to everyone. You may have liked something that a Russian posted on the internet. That's fair enough. Jack. What I want to know, Jack, is will I get an email that will tell me that I may have potentially liked something that an American propaganda agent of influence posted? Maybe an Israeli, the EU, a Saudi? I'd really like to know Saudi. Maybe George Soros, Pierre Omidyar, the other technogarchs, right? Jeff Bezos. Did Jeff Bezos influence? Did he get anything on my Twitter feed that may have influenced me? I want to know this, Jack.
Are you just a
branch of the U.S. government?
We're concerned about this, and it's because we are in media here. What is the impact, Alex? Is it just impacting people like us that are very rigid and constitutionalist when it comes to freedom of speech? Or because my concern, I've said this a number of times on this program, is that they're damaging their own business model. Am I right or am I wrong? Or does it really matter?
You know, I think there's a debate there, how much damage it's going to do to their business model. Because if you take Twitter, not even so much Twitter, I would say Facebook and Google. We haven't mentioned Google is doing a lot of the same practices that Facebook is doing. They're practically much more advanced than Facebook is, to be honest. And they own Instagram, they own WhatsApp, you know, Facebook, and Google owns a variety of properties. And they control 80% of the advertising, Facebook and Google alone, on the internet.
Globally.
Now, what they do to a website, an alternative website, a website that's just getting started or is not as big as, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post, Facebook and Google have the means to either make your site grow very large, or they have the means to completely shut you down. And no one's going to be able to find you. If you can't find the website via Google or Facebook, you're riding in the dark.
You're lost.
So this is a very serious issue. And of course, you can say they're private companies and they have the right to do whatever they want.
They've become utilities now.
Exactly. I agree. But they've gotten to the point where they become utilities. And if they continue this, they need to undergo some sort of regulation because...
But Alex, you know, you had Standard Oil and there was a whole populist... progressive movement to break up this very damaging monopoly. Maybe I'm missing it. Where is the talk about breaking up these monopolies? AT&T, that was a concerted effort. Google and Facebook are some of the most powerful entities that have ever existed.
The most powerful company on the planet. That's Google.
Why would they want to break them up when they're right now operating as U.S. government tools? I mean, the idea that you would break them up, why? They're fully cooperating hand-in-hand with the U.S. deep state. There's no reason for them to. And I think this brings us... Alex brought up the very good point of what the end goal here. The end goal here isn't even not letting you hear what RT or Chinese media has to say. The goal is suppress internal dissent. It is to strangle the alt media, both alt-right, alt-left, right, far-left, either way, the progressives, right? Anything outside the mainstream, anything, you know, but what, like, the New York Times and the Washington Post, which is, by the way, also owned by Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post, what they want you to know, right? I mean, the very slogan, question more, offends them because it really means question them.
I
question their narrative.
All right, Demon, 30 seconds.
Well,
30 seconds.
I can quote the American officials when they accused RT. What did they accuse us of? They said they're so in doubt saying bad things about this amazing country of ours. Well, wasn't so in doubt a European thing since the times of Socrates?
No, it's called the Enlightenment. That's what doubt, that's what the whole Enlightenment was about. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. I want to thank my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.